You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
Welcome to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Now, your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And we're back with the February 1st, 2021 edition of the M Squared TechCast.
Yep.
Got a great show for you today. We're going to kick it off with a frequent guest here on the program, Tamara Shoemaker of Cyber Patriot and University of Detroit Mercy. And I see you've got your your background there like I do, plugging your employer a little bit. Good for you. So tell us a little bit about, let's start off by assuming that people may not have heard of Cyber Patriot. So tell us a little bit about what the Cyber Patriot program is and what's happening with it these days.
So the Michigan Cyber Patriot program was organized to increase the number of students studying the exciting career of cybersecurity and to expose middle school and high school kids to the concepts of cybersecurity in a fun virtual competition. With it easy to be able to drop down into the classrooms, it's got a very low barrier to entry so we can get a really good diverse folks. A group of people involved in it. There are three levels of play. So depending on if you have no background whatsoever, you can play, or if you can reverse engineer the game, you can play. And it runs from October until March every year. This is its 13th season. And in Michigan, we've been going across the state trying to make sure that everybody knows about this program. So we truly appreciate the time that we have on the video cast with you all.
Yeah. And you wrote a column talking about how you're looking for more support from the industry, not only in participation, but perhaps financially as well. Why don't we talk about that?
Absolutely. So each year, we started really working on this about 6 years ago, trying to build up the amount of kids that are involved in this and and supporting those that are in it. And that's no small task. So we have the students to support, we have the schools to support, so the coaches and the mentors. And then what we tried to throw in was this would be the fourth year we would like to have our award ceremony for our hometown champions. So at a national level, there's 28 schools, teams that go head to head at a national level, which is coming up in March, March 20th and 21st. But here locally, we don't really get to celebrate very much the kids that excelled to first, second, and third place in the different divisions here in the state. And so we've been putting on an award ceremony. Well, that doesn't happen for free. We also try to do several locations last year we had 15 separate locations across the state that were going to run summer camps for middle school and high school kids. Again, this isn't free to run. We have, to pay for our upkeep, right? And then this year, I would really like to add a summer camp for third and fourth graders. So much, much lower level with the younger kids. It's really been my goal to make sure that K through 12 all are studying cybersecurity so that at the end of the day, when they come to us at the university level, they already know what they want to do with themselves. They already been exposed to all this. And at the least, they are cybersecure employees for whatever they decide to study, because they've been getting it from kindergarten on. So they know that just like wearing a seatbelt in a car, you have to do something to protect yourself when you go online, whether that's on your phone or computer or your refrigerator for that matter, right?
Okay, everything's smart these days, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so it's really important that we get these kids young and we make sure that they understand without any kind of scare tactics, just empowering them to understand good safety protocols. And so we're looking towards industry right now. So that at the state level, we've gotten a ton of cooperation. So for the last 5 years, they've been supporting us both financially and by getting us into the schools and getting us into all kinds of programs. I sat on a couple of committees at the state level for curriculum and for resources to get enough resources out there for the teachers. But we really need industry to step up at this point. We really need to get some support, like all charities in the state and the nation. It's been very difficult for us to continue this year. This has been a particularly hard year where folks are able to normally give us some support. That most of that support now is going towards COVID, as it rightly should. Right. I mean, it's one of those weird, delicate balances. But I'd like to not have to junk the whole program for a year because of that. Right. So we've got things that are coming up, bills that will be due. And we truly want to have our celebration. We truly want to have our summer camps across the state. And so we're asking industry to maybe put a little skin in the game in this. I know that they want cybersecure employees. I know that they want actual cybersecurity people in their home. Right now, I know LTU. I know that we're not having any problems graduating cybersecurity students and having them go right into industry. And then the feeding war begins, right? Industry's fighting over a certain skill set and employees, so nobody gets to keep anybody for very long because everybody's out trying to outbid each other for them. And so we'd like to stop that. We'd like to sort of have enough graduates, have people that started when they were younger and knew about this and entered that career field and then graduate a much greater number of kids.
So the pay for cybersecurity professionals, I know this from having worked with you guys for a long time, where a kid can come out of college making $120, $130, you know, a year kind of stuff. That's pretty serious wages right out of college, right?
It is. It is. And the other thing, too, to think about it, we also don't want to price ourselves out of jobs. Right. So, I mean, we want our economy to bounce back. We don't want Michigan businesses, especially right now. What's happening is Michigan is getting outbidded by the East and the West Coast for that talent. And so our folks are going all over the country for these wonderful paying jobs. I don't want that to happen. I want there to be enough of these graduates that, you know, you can kind of bring down how expensive they are because they're not this small quantity of them. And I want Michigan to be as supported and as protected as the nation is. So I hate this whole brain drain where we're losing all of our students to all these other areas, but we have to produce more. So we need help to do that.
Matthew?
All right. So tell us a little bit about how the industry can help, how parents can help, how various groups can help you in this effort.
So every little bit counts, right? So we have a website. We have always had a website with our information on it. It's micyberpatriot.com, and there's a very easy button to hit, and it's a tax deductible donation. You can do that, and very easy. It goes right through PayPal's cyber charities. Kind of a thing. You get an automatic receipt that says it's, you know, deductible, and you can go ahead and write it off your taxes. And so that's a real easy way to do that. You can give us a call or email us too if you'd like to do some co-sponsoring where, you know, our stuff is on your website, your stuff is on our website, those kinds of deals and those kinds of things that any normal, you know, charity has, you know, at whatever level you come in. We hope to have our fourth annual award ceremony coming up. And of course, we would be giving out shout outs to everybody and logos on those websites. You know, we would love to see that kind of involvement in the industry level. Right now, what we get was an awful lot of volunteers, and we still want that to happen. We still need people who are in the industry to give back and become mentors in this area and help our teachers. But we truly need some financial support. And it's, you know, it's a click away. It's nice and easy for you to do that.
So how difficult is it? I mean, when you're going down, reaching down to kids, you know, in single figures and in terms of age, how difficult is it to get them excited about cybersecurity? I mean, they may not even totally understand the term, but I know from talking to other folks at other programs that do STEM education, like Matthew's employer, that you've got to get them young.
Absolutely.
To get them interested. And how do you do that? That's got to be tricky, right?
So it's a multi-pronged kind of approach that Cyber Patriot does. It's a national, you know, it's a national group, and they put a lot of time into it. So they have a book series. And so in that book series, they have Sarah the Cyber Hero, and so it's a book series that I could read to my grandchildren, right? And basically all it shows is that being someone who protects the infrastructure and knows good cybersecurity things is helping to protect us all. And so it's just a good hero story, right? Just like you would have a story about firemen or policemen or, you know, any of the other kinds of heroes that we have in our lives. And so it's not necessarily about cybersecurity protocols and things that you need to do, but it's kind of talking about what those people are and how they help protect us. And then there are some, they also provide 3 free games, the National Cyber Patriot Team or program. All you have to do is go to their website and download these lovely interactive games. So they're video games. And during those video games, the kids are playing and they're learning some cybersecurity concepts. They don't know that they're cybersecurity concepts. They just know that if they learn these concepts, they will win the game. And so they get to play these games that teach them things. And one of them is very, very rudimentary. You know, obviously they're made for the level that the kids are at. So it's a little, you know, a little girl, a little boy kind of walking through a park and, you know, a stranger talks to them and, you know, asks them for their password or something. And they learn that, no, you can't talk to a stranger and give them your password, whether it's physically or on the internet. And so you get to, you know, they get to ingrain these little things in that kind of level. The thing that I'm excited about this coming year is that the top cyber patriot coach, in my opinion, who's a good friend of mine out in California, who brings multiple teams to finals every year, has put together a camp for third and fourth graders. That's a tiny, mm-hmm. tiny little bitty level of awareness kind of thing. And I hope to be able to implement that this summer. So we've been focusing on high school and middle school kids. And I'd really like to start a little bit lower too, to sort of get them inspired, get them to start to protect themselves because frankly, Mike and Matt, you know, they're online already.
Oh, yeah. At that age.
And I mean, and especially now when we're all online for school, right? And the teachers can only cram so much in a day, right? So, you know, this is a fun, interactive kind of way of teaching. And I got behind this 6 years ago is that it kind of catches them at the level that they are and inspires them with things that they already like to do.
Mm-hmm. So how do you get this message through to people that maybe, you know, I mean, it's easy to get the message through to people who get the whole idea of coding and software and that kind of thing. But how do you get that through to, you know, the kid who's going to wind up studying literature or theater or something like that? You know, how do you reach those people?
So part of the deal that I'm working on with the state level is making sure that they start to ingrain that in everything that they're doing, right? Because, and especially since we are all online right now, right? So that they just know, and I call it kind of cyber hygiene rather than cybersecurity and anything scary, right? It's just like knowing what you should and shouldn't be doing, right? So, you know, I make the comment when we're in camp, do you know what kind of apps that you're downloading and what kind of permissions you're giving them, right? So my great example is when you download a flashlight app and they want to know your location. I'm using a flashlight app because I need to see something in the dark. I don't need them knowing where I'm at in the dark, right? So, but do we think about any of those kinds of things? No. So maybe we break those kind of, you know, lessons down into things that they can understand. And we work it into all parts of their education, right? Not just if they decide that they want to be coding or they want to go into cybersecurity. It really needs to be an awareness level for all kids.
Right. We're going to have to leave it at that, Tamara. Why don't you tell folks if they want more information about what you're doing, where they go on the internet?
Wonderful. Thank you so much. So www.micyberpatriot.com is my email, and you can find out more information about all the things that we're doing, and you can go ahead and donate. There's just a donate button right there on the page. First thing that you can see. So we appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
All right. Thanks very much, Tamara Shoemaker, University of Detroit Mercy and the Michigan Cyber Patriot Program, literally doing the good stuff for better cybersecurity for all of us here in Michigan. Thanks for being with us today. We'll be back in just a minute with another segment of the M Squared Tech Cast. For right now, it's Matt Rausch
and Mike Brennan.
And you're watching MITechNews.tv.
Lawrence Technological University graduates earn a degree and a higher starting salary. In fact, when it comes to earning potential, the Brookings Institution ranks LTU 5th among U.S. colleges and universities. Be enriched. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
What do you get at Lawrence Technological University? Everything. Great labs and studios, supportive professors, plus a full campus life, NAIA athletics, and all the software you need to succeed. Be smart. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And we're back with another segment of the M Squared TechCast. And we have with us today Dan Radomski. I always want to say Don. Why is that? Usually it's Mike, the one that messes up names. But
yeah, that's my job. So,
okay, welcome, Dan, from the Centropolis Accelerator on the campus of Lawrence Technological University, my employer. And virtually alone, there are one or two others around the state, but not many. It is a business accelerator that deals with hardware, with the physical product companies. Yes, with manufacturers. Here in Michigan, we actually make stuff. And Dan and company help people do that. So, Dan, welcome to the show. And wanted to start things off by asking you, it has been a little over a year since the accelerator opened. How did the tell us how you progressed over the last year or so?
Yeah, thanks. First of all, Matt, Mike, thanks for having me. And yeah, Centropolis Accelerator, we had our grand opening of the facility that we now house, which is a co-working space as well as a prototyping center, October of 2019. However, we've been operating as a hardware accelerator for over 3 years now. So we've had the opportunity to work with a lot of companies, both startups as well as established small business, and helping commercialize many new products. We've helped commercialize over 12 products over the last 18 months alone. And this has been anything from, you know, consumer products, medical devices, clean energy related technologies. So, you know, what we're doing is working, and it's really just, you know, not only using what we have in the way of assets here in the facility, but, you know, connecting these companies with really talented people that understand product design, engineering, tooling, prototyping. We've assembled a number of experts and residents, all 30-year, you know, veterans and experts in this area to help individual companies be successful.
Let's kind of pursue that line of questioning in the sense of an accelerator is to get a company up and running and get it into commercialization, and maybe after that get it funded. Of those 12 companies you just talked about, do any of them have any of them come out of the machine, as it were, with a commercialized product and/or they receive funding?
Yeah, so all 12 of those have been officially commercialized products, meaning they're selling them today. So I'll give an example of one of the companies we worked with, wanted to develop an intelligent fitness machine, portable machine that ultimately will allow you to do any type of exercise you would do in a gym. So we actually helped them with their product design, reduce the complexity, help reduce the amount of components, which helped reduce cost. We helped them with lining up investors, helping them line up manufacturers, and then ultimately, now they have over $2 million in sales of wow. their product and are shipping really all over the world. So
that's fantastic. Hmm. Yeah.
So you recently had your first inaugural client awards ceremony virtually. So tell us a little bit about the companies that brought home the hardware as your top clients.
Yeah, it's great. So it was an opportunity for us really to recognize many companies that were supporting, not just the awardees. So we had nominations in a number of categories. Best hardware product commercialized was the exercise machine that I was referring to, company by the name of Max Pro Fitness. Then we also gave out an award to best manufacturing technology, which went to Flash Steelworks, actually an L2 alum, Gary Cola, that runs that company and developed a next generation method for making high strength steel that you would see in automotive bodies and that type of thing. We also recognized a company for best clean tech technology, Rhombus Energy, who actually designs, engineers, and manufactures high voltage, fast charging electric vehicle chargers. We also had a couple companies win kind of best, you know, products and best pivot in the COVID-19, dynamic of what we went through. And one's a company, Tigris. It's developing an all natural disinfectant material and making that right here in Madison Heights. And then Qualified 3D, a company that pivoted to start developing masks. And then we also had our first ever lifetime achievement award, and we recognized one of our own LTU alum and an expert in residence, David Bolognino. He helps a lot of our clients with prototyping and product design. He used to run General Motors Prototyping Center for a number of years. So we're really lucky to have someone like that on our team to help our individual clients be successful in recognizing their dream and getting their product to market.
Yeah, I'm working on an article for the LTU Engineering College magazine and the Alumni magazine on some of your clients. And I've had the opportunity to interview a few of them now. And the stories of these folks are just amazing. The one you mentioned, the steel company, Flash Bainite, they have developed a new novel heat treating process that makes steel anywhere from 20 to 60% stronger than conventional heat treated steel. Yet it's also more ductile, which means it's easier to bend and shape and form. And that's got applications in everything from automotive to military for armor plating and, impact protection, that kind of thing. Really interesting company. I talked just this morning with the folks at Rhombus Energy, who are involved in high voltage power electronics. And they're basically on the road to putting electric vehicle charging stations that'll charge your car in an hour or two at places like grocery stores, so you can get a full recharge or top off your electrons. I guess not top off the tank, but top off your battery. While you're shopping at Meijer or Walmart or something like that. And that's a company that actually started out here with a couple of Ford engineers who were involved in a very early electric car project for Ford back in the 90s.
Yeah.
And, all of these companies are taking advantage of being on LTU's campus, and they're using the professors, they're using the students. I've made some introductions. I'm sure you have as well. But it's been a real interesting experience to see how this sort of, lets these companies blossom. And that sort of leads me into my next question, which you're also involved in something called the Industry 4.0 Accelerator, which is something that's unique nationwide, as far as we know. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's really a global accelerator. It's in partnership with Automation Alley and Lean Rocket Lab. The three of us manage this accelerator. And what we're really doing, Matt, is we're casting a net globally to find the best Industry 4.0 technology companies. And we're inviting them to be a part of this accelerator. And one of the appealing offers is connecting these companies to existing manufacturers here in the state. So we're seeing applications from all over the world, 230 applications so far in under a year from 30 different countries, quite a bit from Europe, as you would imagine, Germany, Israel. But we're seeing applications in Brazil and Asia and obviously all over the U.S., Silicon Valley, and even quite a bit in our home state of Michigan. But the appeal is really connecting them to all of our corporate partners that are part of the program and their Industry 4.0 tech scouts, their advanced manufacturing R&D people. So we have Magna, Whirlpool, Denso, Bosch, Rexroth, Lear, Forestia, a lot of large manufacturers that we can pipeline these technology companies into, as well as small to medium-sized manufacturers and system integrators that can test out their technology, demonstrate it. And it's really an economic development strategy of ours is to help attract these companies to set up operations in Michigan. But at the same time, by implementing their technologies, you're making the Michigan manufacturers more efficient, right? You're improving their throughput, you're reducing their downtime in the machinery, you're using less labor per unit out the door. And these are all things that obviously we're going to make our Michigan manufacturers more globally competitive in the future at the same time.
Let's talk a little bit how you're managing that in a pandemic situation. And when you say, of course, this isn't going to last forever, we hope, But I mean, how are you managing it now? Are people virtually coming into the center? Are they physically coming in? How are you doing with that?
Yeah, we've been able to keep this center open the whole time. In fact, during the pandemic, we activated our 3D printers and prototyping tools to make face shields that we donated to assisted living centers. But we also still house some meetings sparingly and under the strictest protocols, of course, of safety. But a lot of our work is really virtual, right? I mean, virtual meetings, even the connections we make with the I4O tech companies to these manufacturers are done via web meeting. It has, to your point, though, Mike, been difficult to get, like, let's say, demonstrations done in a manufacturing plant during this time. However, you'd be surprised. We had over a dozen pilots and demos conducted between I4O tech companies and our Michigan manufacturing partners during the pandemic. So, yeah.
So you're also involved now with a new state program called Next Cycle Michigan, supports recycling in the state. Tell us a little bit about that program and what it offers and what your involvement is.
Yeah, it's very exciting. It's actually funded by the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes and Energy, or what's known as EGLE. And it involves an organization out of Ann Arbor called RRS, Recycling Resource Systems, as well as Centropolis. And together, what we're doing is putting together essentially an accelerator for recycling, right? So trying to help companies that have technologies for recycling, where they take waste materials that would be normally go to a landfill, and they have ideas on how to convert those materials to value-added products. So examples of that can be anything from, you know, waste from a food processing center and then converting it into that material into organic fertilizer, as an example. We're also working on a program called ROADS, where we're taking looking for the best ideas to take waste materials like glass, rubber, shingles, and convert them into suitable construction materials for roads and other means. So that is a program that has a multi-year commitment and a lot of funding to help both shovel-ready projects, you know, projects as simple as, you know, taking waste that's currently go to landfill and now composting it, to more technology-based programs like I was mentioning. And we have the ability, Matt, to utilize some of our LTU faculty that are experts in this area. We have one of the best, you know, as you know, civil engineering and construction testing labs in the world here. So we hope to be able to put those to use to help support innovators that come through the program.
All right, we got about 2 minutes left. So what can we cover in 2 minutes?
Yeah. So the other thing we're launching that's of interest is what we're calling a C3 accelerator. It'll be launching at the end of this month. It's really focused on clean tech, climate tech, and circular economy ventures. And just like an Industry 4.0, we're going to cast net globally to try to find the best companies, bring them to Michigan to test out their technologies and commercialize with local Michigan partners. We have funding from several sources, from EGLE, from MEDC, and from the Department of Energy to help support this. And obviously, you know, this is an area that we all care a great deal about and are in a very, you know, important position to try to help bring some of these new technologies to market.
Okay, so if people want access to the Centropolis Accelerator, where do they go online and how do they get a hold of you?
Yeah, so we... you know, you can go on our website, centropolisaccelerator.com, and or you can go through Lawrence Tech University in order to connect directly with the accelerator. And some of our programs, like Next Cycle Michigan, have their own websites. And if anyone's interested, just reach out to us directly and we'll put you in touch with the programs and the services. And especially if anybody out there has ideas for new technologies in this space, glad to see if we can help bring that that idea to reality.
All right. Once again, that's centropolisaccelerator.com. That's CENTREOPOLIS, accelerator.com. Thanks, Dan Radomski, for being with us here today. We'll be back in just a minute with another segment of the M Squared Tech Cast. For right now, it's Matt
and Mike Brennan.
And you're watching MITechNews.tv.
Lawrence Technological University graduates earn a degree and a higher starting salary. In fact, when it comes to earning potential, the Brookings Institution ranks LTU fifth among U.S. colleges and universities. Be enriched. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
What do you get at Lawrence Technological University? Everything. Great labs and studios, supportive professors, plus a full campus life, NAIA athletics, and all the software you need to succeed. Be smart. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Hey, welcome back. It's back. Matt Rausch.
We're coming sitting between here. It's Mike Brennan.
and we're back with another segment of the M Squared TechCast, and we have with us today, as we do every week these days, our very own epidemiology expert, infectious disease expert, Fred Brown. And Fred, there's several things I want to ask you about this week, but first of all, I guess, what do you think is the most interesting thing going on in the pandemic this week?
Well, the thing we're all most worried about are the variants. And we talked a little bit about that last week, and I have a little bit more to say about them this week and give you some clinical results from the trials we've got going. But that's the most worrisome thing I've got going right now. Most interesting thing is just seeing, I'll show you some interesting new data. I'll see what you guys think is most interesting. I have some new data for you guys. So you can see.
Okay.
What
all right. Fire away.
You want to see? So what do you want? Matt had some questions though. So go ahead.
Go ahead, man. What are your other
questions? Well, I just basically wanted to know, where we are in terms of testing for these new variants and what do we do to improve that? Because I heard some very disturbing numbers in terms of how few of the people getting tested are getting tested for one of these new strains. It's a really minuscule number.
Yeah. So our current tests do detect the new strains, but we're having some challenges in that, and especially the tests look for three different kinds of proteins. The ones that are in the are called nucleoproteins that are part of the virus, the ones that are membrane proteins, and the ones that are spike proteins. And because the spike protein has mutated so much, there are some PCR tests right now that can't detect this new the new variant from South Africa and the new variant from Brazil. Mm-hmm. And that's very concerning because you've got to have two out of three positives in order to get a true positive. And what we could be seeing is, because now we are missing one out of the three on some of these tests, we could be getting a lot more false negatives, which means you guys think that you are, that everything's wonderful, but in fact, you've come down with the variant. And the way we really want to get a hold of this is to start to do a lot more genetic sequence testing of all the positive results so that we can identify when things are mutating and how fast they're going. We don't do that, as you know. We only did about 0.28% of all positive test results. So that's not very good. 0.28% is minuscule, as you point out.
So when people get the vaccine, which is not designed or wasn't designed for these variants, if they get the variant, does it minimize the impact of the variant? I know this is kind of convoluted, but I think you understand that, right?
Let me show you. I have some of that data right here. I went last night, and because people were asking me about it quite a bit, and if you like, I can show you what that looks like. Here are all the approved and approvable vaccines that are going to come to our market in the next few months. And you can see on one axis, we've got the variants. And those are so wild type. That's the original Wuhan that we created the vaccine for. And that was all genetically sequenced around January 10th. And then we very rapidly created the spike protein isolate. And we said, we want to just manufacture this protein. And based on that Wuhan spike protein, we now have all these vaccines. And it's literally every vaccine, every medicine that we've got, antibody medicine that we have, is focused on that particular spike protein. And the B1 the B1.1.7 British variant. That's the one that is super reproducible. So we're seeing that, and we've had about 400 cases of that already in California that we've detected. And as Matt pointed out, you can only detect it if you've done a genetic sequence for it. So because we probably have a lot more than that. State of Michigan probably has about 50. We're not sure the exact count. I know of at least 20 we had at last count, and that was last week. So we're probably closer to 50, and that's known. And then we're going to be off the charts if we really started to measure this stuff really rapidly. And you can see that against the wild type or against the original, if you go across it, Moderna, 94.1% effective, and more importantly, the severe cases, you don't have any severe cases if you take that vaccine. Pfizer, if you take the vaccine, 94.8% overall effectiveness, and again, 88.9% against severe. Here's J&J's new release data. They haven't given us the full data set, so I'm always hesitant to talk about this, but we will be getting that. They've unblinded the data set. Everyone has a chance at J&J and the review team to look at this at the FDA. They'll be publishing that analysis in about a week to 2 weeks. I hope that it's about 10 days, 15 days. And then we'll be getting a copy. And then, so maybe next week or the week after, I'll be able to tell you exactly what it is. Overall, 66% against the wild type. But remember, this only had one shot. Pfizer and Moderna vaccine were showing similar effectiveness also after one shot. For moderate disease, 72% effectiveness, severe disease, 85% effective. So you're not likely to get a severe case if you take this one shot. AstraZeneca, 70.2% overall effectiveness. Severe, they didn't have any severe cases in the people who got vaccinated. And Novavax, even better, 89.3% with severe cases being 100% stopped. So you can see we're really good against that one wild type, the original Wuhan virus. That's the original. And the variants, you can see that on the B1.1.7 variant, it's the same. Great news. It reproduces faster. So it's a lot fitter virus. It can reproduce with only with much less vaccine. Viral shedding to you. It grabs you more. And so you need much less of it to make you infected. And it also tends to make you more cough up a lot more. So it's a double effect. You cough up more of it when you get sick with this variant, and it's much more transmittable and links to you much more solidly than the Wuhan one does. So you need less of it. So that's a double whammy, about 70% higher, what they call R0, or reproductive rate. And you can see all the way across that we're good with that particular variant. And that's good because it's in the United States right now, especially in Michigan right now. Then we've got the Brazilian variant. The Brazilian variant is the one we're most worried about. It has the most mutations, has 23 major mutations, and no one's reporting on what their results are. But we know a few things that make me very concerned. First of all, these guys probably do know what the results are, and they're not really ready to tell us yet. And they're also trying to make vaccines, especially for this variant. Because they know what the results are. So Moderna announced they're going to try to make a vaccine just for this variant. And they can do that in one of two ways. One, they can try to create a third booster for you. So if you've had the two Moderna shots, they'll create another booster just for this variant. Or they could go to a point where they call multivalent. That's my area of expertise, multivalent vaccines, where you have more than one antigen in the same vaccine. And that way, with one shot, you're getting antigens for both simultaneously instead of having to do it sequentially. You can see AstraZeneca did do some reporting of this and their overall effectiveness went from 70% to 64%. So a decrease in the effectiveness. What worries me is that Sinovac, CanSino had a big project going on with their vaccine. It's not reported very much because it's not been reviewed yet, and it isn't going to be available in the United States probably because we'll have different and better vaccines. But for that particular vaccine, they had a 65% effectiveness rate reported coming out of Indonesia and a 50% effectiveness rate coming out of Brazil. Huh. That means that's a significant drop. When the drop gets that big, we actually create a new vaccine in the case of a flu. So that's where we're worried that we're starting to get to the threshold of having to create a new vaccine. And now, luckily, we've got the technology to do that relatively rapidly. We think we can probably turn that around, depending on the regulations. You got to get the regulations right. We think we can turn that around in about 5 months. and have, you know, a booster or a special vaccine just for that variant available. We won't have multivalent that rapidly, but at least we'll have something that's for it specifically. Novavax also did not report results. And then we have the South African variant, and this is also a concerning one because we saw, I showed you last week, the brand new data sets that showed 10 times neutralization decrease, and there's 6.4% reduction in binding. So what that means is our immune system works in two ways. The first way, first thing it does is it tries to find stuff that's foreign and glom onto it and say, hey, come on over here. There's a foreign thing over here. And they try to beat it up. And that's step one. And that is the antibody binding, right? So when it has a 6.4 times reduction in antibody binding, that's not good because that means more of the virus is reaching your cells. The next thing that has to happen is once it gets into the cell and starts to infect the cell, your body has a second response. That's a T and C cell response. And it comes and blows up those cells. It purposely kills them, which is right. So those are the two, and that's the neutralization antibodies. So that's 10 times lower. So not only can't you fight off the virus before it gets to the cell, but after it gets to the cell, you can't blow it up, which means that it continues to reproduce and infect you. So we're very concerned about those numbers, and that typically is on the edge of having to say we might have to develop something special. So you can see that overall, J&J went from 66% overall effectiveness to 57% effectiveness. Again, you know, that's a pretty significant drop, almost about an 18% drop. And then AstraZeneca did not report the results separately. They combined all these tests and said, well, you know, we put all of it together and, you know, South Africa's in there somewhere, but we can't see it. And Novavax, this was really shocking. Novavax, which is a slightly different technology, uses different protein particles to vaccinate, it went from 89% effectiveness to 49% effectiveness. Yes. That's a shocker. Now, it still prevented 100% severe disease, which is what we're really interested in, but that's a real shocker. So, and they did report separately, and that's the one that's everyone looking at going, holy cow, that could be a problem. Given that everyone else is sort of funny about reporting what's going on with these variants, right?
The typical flu vaccine, I've heard many people, I don't know if you've addressed it, but I've heard other people address it, is not very particularly effective, right? I mean, I get my flu shot every year. Sometimes I still get the flu. So, I mean, that's down to the 20 or 30% effective range, and maybe something like that.
It's 40 to, well, we like to say it's 40 to 60% effective. It's been around 45% effective.
Okay.
If you look over the past 20 years, and we had a couple of really bad years where it was only, you know, down the 10% effectiveness rate, which is unacceptable, obviously. That was early 2000s. We just misguessed which strains would be most prevalent. And so we didn't choose the right ones. We're getting better at that now on our global basis. I can show you some of that data next time. I just have to run through a whole bunch of slides in order to, I have all the data, but I wasn't ready to talk about the flu today. But we can do that maybe next week.
Sure. Now, the situation that's going to arise, though, when old people like me and Matt finally get scheduled for our vaccines, we're not going to have a choice. They're just going to give us what they have, right?
I think we're probably going to go to a one-shot strategy. I pointed out that the break-even for the one-shot strategy in terms of saving lives, I thought we would save about 20,000 extra lives if we went to a one-shot strategy over the next 3 months. And that's not to say we're going to have just one shot. But it means we're going to come back a little bit later than we would otherwise for that second shot. It'll probably be 12, you know, it may be, you know, instead of 4 weeks, it might be, you know, 12 weeks, but in that range. And that the reason for that is that we are really going to have a trouble with these variants. If we look like the UK does right now, I showed you that data. It showed basically they locked everything in. And then despite locking everything in, nothing happened. And they're going door to door now doing tests. That's in London and outside London, and that's like Essex and Surrey counties. So those are the big, you know, the big counties outside of London. They're going door to door and saying, swab, please. They want to find out how prevalent this thing is, what they're up against. And I think we're going to be in Southern California and Florida real quick.
Pretty scary.
There, yeah. So, yeah.
Well, we have some of that UK variant here in Washington County. I don't know how many cases, but I've seen it come through in some reports.
Yeah, it's about 20 cases right now.
Okay.
Unofficially. Now, what's interesting is I've been working with the country of Israel, and Israel has been vaccinating a lot. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to find out whether there's any effect. And there's some good initial data. Now, it's not perfect, but here's data from last night. I didn't get a chance to put it up and make it nice. But what we had was two big surges through Israel. One went through a few months ago, and then we locked down. And you can see that what happened when we had the big surge, the second wave is that blue wave. That's the blue part. And that was really before we had vaccinated anyone. The vaccines weren't really available yet. They just were starting to roll out. And you can see what happened. It was 12, this is the population over 60. And the reason we want to look at the population over 60 is because we actually, on the third wave, we've had three waves now, on the third wave, we actually had vaccinated the people over 60. So you wanted to see the difference between what would happen in the population over 60 when they weren't vaccinated and when they were vaccinated. And look at the blue line. The blue line shows that, we had about 12% of the population and it dropped down. Then we locked in that solid line is when that black line is where we locked in. And then you can see, despite the lock-in, the population of percentage of cases over in the 60 populations, because they're largely more more settled. They're less likely to distance. They're all together in nursing homes and apartment buildings and so on. That's the elderly population in Israel. And you can see that the thing just takes off, that blue line. Mm-hmm. A few months ago, we had another wave. And at that point, we vaccinated a lot of the population. Over half of the population was vaccinated by the point of that dotted line. And you can see that instead, so we were pretty much parallel, right? 14 dropping down to about 12, 12 dropping down to about 10. Very parallel lines, right? Everything looks about the same. But the vaccinated population this time, it keeps going down. It doesn't take off again. And that is significant, I think. You can see that the difference in the first few days, it's a 30% drop in the rate of people when you've gotten vaccination, when you've been vaccinated, you're 30% less likely in those first few days of a bad upswing, you're 30% less likely to become ill. So that's a good sign, right? You'd much rather be on that yellow curve than on that blue curve, right? If you're over 60. Right now it's gone down to 7%. 7% this morning. So we were happy about that. It shows, these are all Pfizer vaccines. They're on the Pfizer, they're on the BioNTech Pfizer vaccine. But you can see that in populations now, we're starting to be able to see the effect of a vaccine. So that's cool. There are a couple things about the vaccine that we want to talk about that I wanted to make sure people knew. And that is you have to know how to optimize your vaccine response, right? Because when you guys get it, you don't want to have a suboptimal response. You want to have a great response. And there are a couple of things that we found out, basically. The first is, if you're trying to get an immune response and get that immune response strong, you don't want to be taking ibuprofen or acetaminophen. Because that actually reduces your immune response and reduces the learning of your immune system. So I know you're going to feel pain, fatigue, kind of not so great after this. If it's about pain, use ice packs. Don't use ibuprofen or acetaminophen. Otherwise, you won't have as good a response as possible. And we've seen this several times, especially the flu vaccine, and we're seeing this now in the COVID vaccine with people who were in a group that took ibuprofen, because they felt badly afterwards, and those who didn't, and we saw a much better immune boost with those who did not take the ibuprofen or acetaminophen afterwards. So that just came out, and it's just sort of basic vaccinology, but it's important to do. If you want to take things that would enhance your immune response, omega threes will do that. Vitamin D3s will do that. Vitamin C, vitamin B12 complex will do that. So there are some things you can take. People likely melatonin will help you with that. So there are some medicines you can take to actually boost your immune response, but not acetaminophen and ibuprofen.
How about bourbon?
Well, I was going to say, does whiskey mitigate the pain? I'm on board with that.
So far,
does that have an effect one way or the other?
The effects of alcohol
make it all feel numbing. Better.
they're numbing and probably helpful. Okay. Just for a day or two, though. Nothing. You might have an even worse hangover and on day three or four than you otherwise would have, though.
All right, gotcha.
Of course, you want to have a good night's sleep. Get some exercise the day before, probably, go out walking with your dog or something. That means 15, 20 minutes to get your heart rate up a little bit. Avoid stress. Stress actually depresses the immune system.
Avoid stress. Okay. My life
like a
is
pandemic
stressed.
And a depression. Yeah, that's
yeah. Really other than that, everything's perfect. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's how you avoid. Yeah, that's WC Fields cure to insomnia is to get plenty of sleep. That's the only.
Yeah, right.
So anyway, those are some things. If you are taking your vaccine, lucky enough to get on the list, this is how you really optimize your response. In the meantime, you want to make sure that you use an N95 mask. These new variants are too tough for your cotton masks. The cotton masks are about three times less effective than a surgical mask. And that surgical mask is about 30% less effective than an N95 mask. So you get a sense that it's about four times better to use an N95 mask, and the technology makes a difference. What you want to look for is a NIOSH certification on your mask. And so, sadly, a lot of manufacturers have forged this, but there are some other clues. You can go to the CDC website, and they'll actually show you all of the NIOSH fake masks. And then NIOSH has a list of all the masks that they've actually approved on their website. But basically, there are a couple of big red flags on it. It'll actually have a NIOSH approval number right on all the masks and the labeling. Mm-hmm. And you can actually go and look at NIOSH's equipment list, the cell list they've got, and they'll tell you and confirm that you've got the right one. And there are some links here that people can look at NIOSH Trusted Source page.
What I've discovered, though, Fred, unless you're a healthcare or a first responder, they won't sell you an N95 mask. So I was forced to buy the KN95, which is the Chinese knockoff.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's as effective, but that's the only thing I had my physical last week, and even my doctor wasn't able to get N95 masks.
Okay, well, so I was able to without any problem, but I may have just been lucky. I don't know, or knew who to go to and things like that. I'll ask my source about that. I wasn't aware that people were having trouble with it, but I know that they're pretty easy to get fake ones. And here are some things that you want to make sure that they aren't fake. As I said, no, everything will have a number on it. Everything will be marked NIOSH, and it won't be decorated with stuff at all. And
that plain white, right?
Yeah, white or blue, and it'll include the white, and it'll include the NIOSH number on the strap, and the straps that go around your ear. Big red flag. That's not going to be solid enough. Make sure you fit them right, though. And if they're uncomfortable, then wear a surgical mask instead of a cotton mask if you can get it. Apparently, I guess, though, they're both also difficult to get. But as I said, I haven't had any trouble yet myself. So let me know about that. If people have trouble, I can get you some contacts. So at any rate, we were talking last week about. Well, a few things, right? We talked about the fact that production was sort of different. We talked about the kind of the three or four factors that were causing us to have trouble getting the vaccines out. And right now we're running at about 1.5 million vaccines a day. Pretty good, from where we were just in a month. But to give you a sense of this, right now Michigan has inoculated about a million people. Hmm. If we were running at Israel's rate, we would have inoculated 5 million people, about 4.5 million people. So you can get a sense of just how much more aggressive some of these other countries are than what we're able to be. So we talked about why that was. And the first thing we said was manufacturing is hard. Second thing we said was distribution is hard. And then after we get it to the people at the distribution site, it turns out that convincing people to take this miracle, I mean, it really is a miracle, is also hard. There's a good segment of the population that doesn't want to take the vaccine for one reason or the other. I'm not sure why not. It's an adult vaccine. You know, it's not, I know people have some issues with vaccinating some of the children. They've had some reports that they're concerned about that. Those reports haven't been borne out with the scientific data, but people have concerns anecdotally. With COVID, we do not have any of those concerns. I mean, we're talking about, the chance of you having an allergic reaction, just an allergic reaction. Your chance of you dying is about 1 in 50 million so far. Chance of you having an allergic reaction is about 1 in 1 million. Maybe between one and ten in a million, depending. And those people who have gotten allergies, 71% of those knew in advance they were going to have an allergy, and the remaining 29%. Were largely allergic to polyethylene glycol, PEG. And so if you want to really, avoid that, take some Benadryl in advance. If you think you're going to have an allergic reaction, bring your EpiPen, because the only people who are having bigger allergic reactions are people who have known allergies. If you've got a PEG, if you've got a polyethylene glycol allergy, the way you'd know that is if you have trouble preparing for your colonoscopy exams. Turns out polyethylene glycol is the happy stuff that you have to take before you take your colonoscopy. so that runs.
None
right
of those through. Are happy anywhere in that. So
if you've had an allergic reaction to that stuff, you may want to talk to your doctor about. Other than that, we have not found anything that would cause anybody to have any questions about whether the risk rewards are offset. You've got a 1 in 900 chance of dying of COVID in that stage right now.
Wow.
I mean, and this is a versus a 1 in 1 million chance of even having an allergic reaction, and a 1 in 50 million chance of possibly dying. Hmm. So, we're talking about that kind of offset as far as rewards go versus the risk. However, there is a large population who is just naturally resistant, and here is what we're finding. It's a sort of a knee jerk reaction for some reason. It's not scientific. I just told you what the data is. So if we start with a slideshow here, I'll just show you some of the results. And what we're finding is that we need to get to about originally we thought an 82% overall vaccination rate plus people who've been sick rate. So the overall immunology being protected of 82%. That's what we thought our number was. With these new variants, it's likely to be 90%. 90% of us have to have be immune from the virus in order to stop it. And by stopping it, I mean that enough of us are there to avoid it bouncing off somebody and hitting somebody who's susceptible. So if enough of us are there blocking the virus, eventually it can't find any hosts. That has to be 90%. So 1 in 10 of us can still be unvaccinated. And we'll still be pretty safe and not have to worry about outbreaks. But if we go to 2 in 10, 3 in 10, we're going to have outbreaks. And that's the problem. And the problem is you have outbreaks is, as we saw, you have a lot larger gene pool and more variants occur. And that suddenly makes your vaccines less effective. Mm. So if you suddenly move your vaccination effectiveness from 90% to 50%, all of a sudden, even you vaccinate everybody, you can't get enough people. You can't get enough people vaccinated to protect the rest of us.
I see two issues there. One, there's a lot of anti-vaxxers out there. I don't know what the percentage is.
I can tell you on this chart.
And two, I think it's also unfortunately turned into a political issue.
Yeah.
Where a lot of people who are Trump supporters think all this is all hogwash. Anyway, it's all made up. So achieving 90% may be problematic.
Well, that's what we're worried about, right? So it's the number is vaccine effectiveness stopping transmission, which we've found out now may be going down a little bit, times the percent of inoculated plus the recovered as a percent of the population. That is the level of control you've got. And when we know the R0 is probably 1.15, then the overall herd immunity has to be more than 55%. And in truth, it'll have to be as it moves, because these new variants are much more transmissible, so 70% more transmissible. So all of a sudden, your herd immunity levels go up. so we've got a double whammy. our vaccines are less effective, and it's more transmissible. So our herd immunity levels actually have to be bigger. And so you can see the numbers in the little yellow box. The vaccine hesitant, we've labeled them. The anti-vaxxers are about 9% of the population. So 9% of the population off the bat is not going to take the vaccine. We can't convince them. They are convinced the vaccines are, for some reason, not the right thing for them. And so we're already, even if we inject, inoculate everybody who's not an anti-vaxxer, we're just going to be at the border of being protected. And then we've got a whole bunch of people, as you point out, who are angry disbelievers. Those are the people who, as you point out, don't believe it's real. And those are about 20% of the population right now. They just don't believe that COVID's that problematic. It's sort of like the flu. It'll go away. I'm not sure how they got this idea because it sure hasn't.
I know it's called Fox News, but go ahead. So,
well, I don't recommend watching that Fox.
No,
they're spreading that. I can't believe they can't that it's pretty obvious that we've got a problem with COVID. So that'd be hard to offset with any news. Then we have the cultural resistors, and those are people that's the Black community, have been in the past badly discriminated against, right? They've had the Tuskegee experiment. They've had cells taken from them and created brand new fabulous drugs and haven't been compensated appropriately. They had all sorts of things that where people have lost their trust in the medical community and for a good reason. So that's 15% of the community. And then there are skeptical laggards, and those are people who say, "Well, I can be convinced, but I want to see the data first, and let's have my cousin's aunt take the first one, and then I'll decide how she does, and but slowly but surely we'll get there." And basically, I think that is about 20% of the population. So overall, we're looking at over 50% of the population who are gonna need some push. Now, the skeptical laggards, I think, are convincible. And slowly but surely, we're watching that. I'm willing to take a vaccine move from, kind of 50% where it was to closer to 70%. But now I think we're going to start to have some real slowdown. I think once you get to 70%, getting from 70 to 80, that's going to be pretty hard. 80 to 90 is going to be almost impossible. And over 90 is really impossible just because of what people's positions are. And part of the problem, is the anti-vax movement. And I think we're going to lose the battle, the social media battle that we have that's coming up to fight. And you can see that there's some real big things. There's quite a bit of money to be made in being an anti-vaxxer. It turns out you can sell alternative to vaccines. they haven't been through the FDA process, haven't really been tested very well, but an alternative, like take the special vitamin I just developed. It'll make you feel better and probably help you avoid viral transmission or something, flunky like that. It isn't really a claim, but sounds good. The FDA really can't police. And of course, they sell books, and they sell services and food supplements and courses. And then they complain the pharmaceutical industry is making all sorts of money on people who are taking vaccines. So it's sort of an interesting dichotomy to watch, the whole thing. They're largely unregulating, do whatever they like. The message that there are is that vaccines are dangerous to your health. Now, because they can't really demonstrate that with COVID, what they've done is that they've moved that to, I have a right to say what I want. So if you talk to an anti-vaxxer today, they won't really say, well, it's dangerous because they have no basis for that. They'll say, well, I can say what I want. And they say, yes, you can, but why would you want to spread, false information like that? And the answer goes back to, well, there's some money in it for people and there's a happy community that's doing quite well with this. Thank you very much. There's lots of natural alternatives. So unfortunately, when you go to the internet sites today and you say, I'm worried about my new child that's been born. What kind of good nutrition can I get? And if you click childhood nutrition, which is a good thing to click and figure out more about, if you're a brand new mother, for example, you will guaranteed have an invitation to visit a new site called Why Vaccines Will Kill Your Child, which have no basis in reality, but are attached to these other sites that are promoting relatively good practice. And that's very disappointing to see. And it's something that the people who are creating these sites don't do naturally, but it's something that the search engines do because it promotes more views, right? As soon as, oh my God, I don't want to kill my child. What else? I want to find out more about that. And you get sucked in to these false claims that aren't regulated. And that's a real shame. And you can see that basically it's there's going to be a fight, and the fight is for the middle. And this is what things looked like in 2019, late 2019, if you actually took a view of everything that was followed through in terms of the vaccination community. There is the blues who think that vaccines are great, and then there are the reds who are anti-vaxxers. And then there's the green who don't really know, right? And you can see that the green are the biggest number. The anti-vaxxers are, if I had to look at this and say, my guess is the undecideds were about 60%, the anti-vaxxers were about 30%, and the pro-vaxxers were 20%. Now, the pro-vaxxers, those are largely scientists, you know, who are saying, you know, you should take the vaccine because we've done all the science, and they're sort of in their little silos, and they're thinking that science will overcome all things eventually, and the numbers will speak for themselves. The anti-vaxxers, though, basically move at their own rate. They can invent, you know, new conspiracy theory and falsehoods as fast as you like. And as many as you like. They are looking kind of for people who are interested in vaccinations. And unlike the vaccination guys who are basically looking for new NIH grants, these guys are actually looking for people who can be convinced. And so if you're an undecided and you want to hit refresh every once in a while to find out what's new, there's not much going to be happening on the scientific side. I mean, science happens at, you know, when I did vaccines, it took me 15 years to develop some mitovaccines. Vaccines. So, you know, I can't compete with the anti-vaxxer side. So they're going to keep the refresh, and they're going to say, oh my goodness, there's more stuff about this. Look at this. You know, it turns out you can grow a second head if you take a vaccine, or X, Y, and Z happened in outer Slobovia. Isn't that interesting? And so you'll have a lot more information about the anti-vax side of the equation than you will the vaccination side. And if you look at that quote up on top, 2/3 of the time when a user joins an extremist group on Facebook, it's because Facebook's algorithms recommend it. So what Facebook and Reddit and YouTube and Twitter and Medium all have done is they've looked at this huge amount of volume of data and said, we can help you with that. We'll create algorithms that will help steer you toward the right information that you are most interested in. But the quote unquote right information for Facebook and YouTube are those sequence of clicks that keep you on their media longer. It's not the sequence of clicks that give you the information fastest and best. It's not one that takes you to experts. It's not one that takes you to vetted information. It's one that takes you to memes that are clever and are popular, not to an expert. And of course, my website, you know, suffers from that. So I'm slightly biased, but I can tell you that, you know, doing this myself for a while, you're going to get a compelling and very interesting meme that keeps you in their environment a lot longer, much more likely than you would get an expert view. And you can get a sense that what the pro-vaccinators need to do in order to do this is doing what we're doing. We're trying to pre-bunk some of this, right? Especially around safety and efficacy and why things went so fast and why it's such a great opportunity. We have to counter and start to instill confidence. Right now, it's easy to find onesie-twosie anecdotes about some 90-year-old man who was on his deathbed, took the vaccine, and 3 days later died. Well, that has nothing to do with the vaccine. We have not been able to find any correlation between an increased death rate and taking a vaccine. If it was, it wouldn't be on the market. The FDA would take it off. So that's why we're going to lose this social media battle. We're not going to win it. It's impossible. We can't win it because it's not a playing field that we compete in, and it's not one that we're interested in. Unfortunately, most people get their news today. 50% of people get to the news today from these social platforms and not from a respected expert.
We've only got a few minutes left, and this is actually something I throw at you over the weekend. I don't know if you've had a chance to talk to the WHO folks yet. Go ahead.
Not yet. So there are a few friends of mine are part of the WHO. They're on site at Wuhan now. They're going through, they've been invited into the labs. We'll see whether or not that happens or not. They've looked at the fresh market. They haven't been able to report much yet. I don't know whether it's just because it's the time change.
Well, let me finish my thought, because it came up on a nationally syndicated show, Bill Maher, over the weekend.
Wanted to ask you about that too.
Where I don't know who those people were on the show. I don't know what their background is, but they made a pretty convincing case that this was a man-made virus. And that was the original theory way back when this got started, that they were developing biological weapons in Wuhan and they escaped the lab. I don't know if it was quite that sinister, but they're making the case that this didn't look like a nature-created virus. It looked more like a man-created. But again, I know we don't know, but I mean, people are talking about this now.
Yeah, they've been talking about it, you know, since the beginning, and we are worried about whether that may have been an escape virus, or you know, already in December. Why is there so much concentration of pneumonia even in December of 2019?
Right.
So we were thinking about that for a while, and a couple of things. Number one, one thing that people will bring up, and rightfully so, is that this is a virus. Normally, the natural progression of the evolution of a virus is that it becomes more transmittable, but less deadly. And the reason you want to kill off all your hosts. However, in this case, that's for epidemics, you know, if you're finding a limited number of hosts already. In this case, we're all talking about a pandemic. So this is all over the world. It's not just, you know, in isolated areas. So we're getting a lot more genetic mutation and a lot more selection for different kinds of viruses than we normally would have. So overall, I think it's still very unlikely that this is an escape virus. I think it's likely just arisen from nature, and that we will have to fight it as that. Even if it was a man-made virus, there's not much difference you would do, you know, unless it was purposely developed and then had a natural. A natural way of killing it that you created also, which is normally what we do. We make these things as they can't reproduce, or they can't spread virulence, or we create that kind of we put in some codes that will, you know, kill the virus off that we're creating. And these sites are extremely, you know, booked down. It's very hard to imagine that it would escape without a lot of overlapping systems having failed simultaneously. We would have known about that in the community, I think. So I think it's highly unlikely, but there are some things about the virus that are weird, you know, and we don't know very much. We're still finding out, frankly. So I'm going to keep an open mind if they find something there are some things that are weird about this virus that would indicate that there's some evidence that you could build up slowly but surely, and said that, you know, this is a little bit different than what we expected, but, I don't think it's overwhelming yet. If these guys come back from the WHO with reports that indicate that there's evidence of this, then there's a lot more to talk about. But so far, I haven't seen any evidence that's convinced me. And I've talked to people who are, you know, close to this, and they're also not convinced about a possible escaped virus.
Okay.
There are a lot of things wrong with that theory that
sure,
can't go into too much because it would violate. Well,
we're going to have to end it on that note. Certainly, if you... in future shows, if you find out there's more to this, or even if it's, you know, debunked, we need to go either way, because right now it's circulating. Bill Maher gets millions of viewers, and so all these people that, like me, that watched it with, you know, holding my breath watching that segment, wow, you know. And again, that was the original conspiracy theory way back a year ago, was this escape from Wuhan lab, blah, blah, blah. Yep,
that's right.
People want to know one way or the other, right? You know.
Yeah, so. And a few years ago, last year, at about this time, I was looking at that evidence and found that I wasn't convinced. If you want, if you can send me a copy of that video, I'll take a look at it and we'll go through
Actually,
it.
Actually, I did. I sent it to you.
I'm sorry.
On Saturday.
Okay, I will.
YouTube link. Take a look at it. If you don't find it, I'll send it to you again.
I'm sorry. I'm getting about 400 messages.
I know you get flooded with stuff. So,
but I will look at it. I promise, and I'll let you guys know, and I'll tell you. You know, I will go through it point by point. Absolutely.
Sounds great. All right, take us out, Matt.
All right. Well, thanks very much once again to Fred Brown, our very own epidemiology and infectious disease expert, for that enlightening coverage today. We'll be back next Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time with another edition of the M Squared TechCast. For right now, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're watching MITechNews.tv.
Thanks for listening to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Join your host.